Welcome to EarthFeed, From Soil to Shelf, where packaging expert and yoga enthusiast Kelly Williams helps small and medium brands transition to sustainable packaging. This podcast is brought to you by Earth First Compostable Packaging Solutions.
Thank you for listening in on the first episode of the EarthFeed podcast, Soil to Shelf. And that's a podcast really about materials of the future for packaging. So with me today, I have three distinguished folks from the technology development side, the real molecule benders of the future of packaging I have with me today, and I'm so excited to have them here. So let me introduce them. So first we have Dr. Peter Sosilski. He's a senior research scientist and distinguished member of the research staff at the National Renewables Energy Laboratory, also known as NREL in Golden, Colorado. He's a chemical engineer with a PhD in material science, over 15 years developing bio-based fuels, chemicals, and materials, has over 120 scientific publications, and leads multiple projects funded by the Department of Energy. Then we have Dr. Emma Master, professor of chemical engineering and applied chemistry at the University of Toronto, associate director of BioZone Center for Applied Bioscience and Bioengineering, where they design and test enzymes that can customize natural materials, such as cellulosics and hemicellulose. Since 2011, she has had a research team at the Aalto University in Finland, where I think you are today, and to scale up and de-risk promising biotechnologies. And then also co-founded Wyzymes in 2021 to accelerate technology translation and benefits to diversified biorefineries. And it may tap into that topic a little bit as well. And then we have Dr. Jake Miller, research scientist also at NREL, chemical engineer with over 10 years developing bio-based fuels, chemicals, and materials, more than 10 scientific publications, and currently leads and contributes to multiple projects funded by the Department of Energy. So welcome. Thank you for joining me. So what I want to really get from you to share with our audience is just how real we actually are to taking natural materials and valorizing them to do the things that fossil-based extractions, catalytic conversions, thermomechanical manipulations, polymerization, all the things that we're doing today, we can actually do those things from natural materials. We just have to unlock it. So I'm going to start this conversation off with something that Peter said to me when I first met him. Peter, going back probably 6-7 years, you said to me that after many years of researching how to take nature and break it down to make fuels, that there's a general understanding that you'll never fully recover the value of that intact polymer that was created by nature's preferred monomer, which is CO2, not ethylene, not propylene, not 1,4-butanediol, but CO2.
You know, I arrived at that conclusion basically looking at all the different products you can make from biomass, and then also looking at all the different products that nature makes, you know, and that, as you mentioned, how, you know, our society has been really advancing our own polymerization technologies. But biology is still king of polymerization. I mean, absolutely king. Mass producing polymers all the time. And I mean, we're probably sitting on wooden desks right now, you know, so that's a biopolymer. You, me, Emma, Jake, we're all made of biopolymers. This plant behind me is a biopolymer. And we all have really different properties. And so a lot of the features of performance characteristics that we're looking for in these synthetic polymers, biology already offers them in some way, you know, and the trick is understanding, you know, the slight modifications, maybe that Emma will talk about, you know, we can still rely on some chemical catalysis, maybe Jake will touch on that, to modify these things to give us the performance characteristics that we're after. And we really, you know, you've used this term before, nature does offer you a menu already of things that it's making. Mm-hmm. And we can rely on modern biotechnology and catalysis to tune the menu, season the menu, if you will, to our own taste. So, yeah, start with that.
Oh, that's really good. I like that one, season the molecules. That's wonderful. Yeah, I feel similarly. You know, there's a lot of interest in throwing AI at material science, right? And thinking about how to design a material for certain performance attributes or for, you know, multi-purpose use. And then you remember the plant biopolymer, the plant fiber, which has evolved over hundreds of millions of years with parallel processing. You know, like there's a lot of innate value there. And the fact that we use it today for lumber and paper and make pellets for burning, you know, that's just reflecting our lack of imagination, not the lack of functionality that's really right in front of our faces.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Emma. I think to add what you guys have said, I think the first thought I have is, you know, I like the way that you described the situation that we're in right now as a quagmire, Kelly, because the first thing I thought of is that, you know, if we think about quagmire being a swamp, there is an incredible amount of bioresources that are available in a swamp. Mm-hmm. You just have to figure out how to use them. I mean, there's, in terms of the diversity of microbial life that's there, and the types of molecules, and most of which are polymers that they're building, there's a ton. The one thing that I think I can add here is that, you know, Emma was kind of talking about plants as in, you know, these organisms, but I'm sure the plant that you're more familiar with, Kelly, are mm-hmm. chemical plants that we use to manufacture our synthetic polymers. And I was actually just having a conversation with a colleague of mine at NREL earlier, Andy Young, where we were talking about how the need to change the feedstock for so many of the valuable materials that we use for our continuing existence and standards of life as humanity may necessitate us rethinking how we deal with chemical plants and making them a lot smaller to deal with localized resources. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is it's very easy to put crude oil, not easy, but it's, you know, well established, crude oil on a ship or in a pipeline and move it thousands and thousands of miles. But it's very much more difficult to do the same thing with tree bark, with corn stover, those kinds of things. And because of that, I think we can start to really, there's a lot of space for us in the R&D community to reimagine how conversion facilities look, the types of unit operations and processes that they use, and the scales that they operate on.
I'm really glad you said that, because I feel like we need to start when people say, but is it scalable? Let's pause that question, because I don't think we understand the word anymore. Scale doesn't mean a single plant that does 800 tons a day. Scale means deployability. How do I make 50 of them in all the right places to valorize these natural intact materials to then manipulate them to do all of these things we need? So I agree with you, because if you think about the history of packaging, and again, this is a packaging oriented, but for me, it's about the materials. It's the science of the materials. Packaging is just an undeniable important place for those materials, because again, you can't support 8 billion people without packaged consumer goods. We can't even design packaging that stays in one piece when we open it, let alone manage the litter for which it causes. But if you, you know, fast forward to where that is now, and like, how do we get here? How do we get to this enormous mountain of plastics waste? It's actually not too hard. It's so easy to, people will say, you know, experience in an area is important, but if you're a professional business development person, you don't need to know the market you're doing business development in. You can learn it. It's hard to argue that. But I'm telling you, if you're trying to predict the future and you're doing it from the current state, your projection is inaccurate because you have to involve the right historical components of information. You have to build history to project forward. That improves your extrapolation accuracy. We're not adding that. So let's look at the history of packaging. PVDC-coated cellophane and glassine-coated paper allowed the general store to become a grocery store. That was packaging. So we discovered polyethylene through free radical polymerization back again when people just explored stuff and tried stuff. And we're like, well, what's it good for? Wire and cable. We needed it for World War II. So polyethylene had like a very clear fit, but we made ethylene from oil. So when you crack oil to make ethylene, you make a shitload of propylene. What do you do with propylene? There's a lot of derivatives for propylene, but there was so much of it. Well, we can make polypropylene. You can't blow polypropylene, but you can sheet it and stretch it really fast, really pristinely. So now we have this material that we can make really thin, super clear, very fast. What's it good for? No oxygen barrier at all, but it has moisture barrier. So I can make things that are sensitive to moisture perform. That's when we started to see monolayer blown film go to 3-layer to 5-layer, short stint at 5, straight to 7, because we had to start putting oxygen barrier in our polyethylene film because cellophane carried oxygen. Cellophane got replaced by this pristine plastic. So what that allowed us to do globally is build these enormously large supply lines. So I could take printed packaging in Germany, send it to San Diego to put frozen seafood in it, and I can sell that frozen seafood in Southeast Asia, Canada, US, or back in Germany, and it all works. I don't think that's not decarbonization. That is a carbon dilemma. And it's a supply chain that's fatigued and vulnerable, and it's only another pandemic, climate event, socioeconomic, those supply lines will continue. The only way to fix it is to bring it to the source and start to build these materials. And so I agree with you completely. And then it becomes a little bit more plausible as to how you use enzymatic modification. How do you actually now use, and I want your thoughts on this too, Peter, on nanocellulose, because now nanocellulose, which is 97% water because it's nanocellulose. You've got to keep water in there. It slaps together and you can't get it apart. But you can't ship 97% water all over the place, but you can make it locally and convert it locally into a new pellet that is not paper nor plastic. It's a pellet that does what it's supposed to do, and it's both recyclable and biodegradable.
Yeah, there's a lot of points I want to touch on, Kelly, but I think I'll hit on the first one. So, and it's circling back to this degree of deconstruction. So, you know, but what nature gives you in biomass is really a lot of stored solar energy and sequestered CO2. And every time you break those bonds, polymeric bonds, you're forfeiting a little bit of that energy. And oftentimes you're forfeiting a little bit of that carbon as well. So really the home run is, can you use intact biopolymers in their native form to you know, for the applications that you need? It's hard. If it was easy, we'd be doing it all over the place. You know, so you can just cellulose, if you can extract cellulose, which we can easily now, you can go a long way with that, right? Paper is a fantastic product. There's all sorts of great packaging materials that you can make from paperboard and so forth. You know, lignin's great. Hemicellulose also has its applications. But, you know, in some cases, we actually need drop-in replacements, or, you know, functional replacements or drop-in replacements. And a lot of times in the current state, that requires that we really depolymerize everything back down to monomers, you know, monomeric sugars, you know, lignin monomers and so forth, and then build them back up. And that's inherently less energy efficient than just using, I mean, the best thing you can make out of a piece of wood is a baseball bat, right? Everything's intact, right? You don't even do any chemical modification. You use the polymers just as they're in. But if we need, you know, certain specialty barrier film, for example, that are hard to access from, you know, native biopolymers in their, you know, in their native state, we've got to break them down and build them back up the way that we're used to. I mean, that's a lot of that's just to handle our own infrastructure. So, you know, that's a stepping stone, if you will. I mean, I think the home run is, you know, some of the work that more like Emma is doing, where, you know, maybe you can genetically modify plants to alter their biopolymeric structure and grow the polymers you need. But that's, again, that's kind of the limit of our biotechnology at this point. There's other intermediate steps that Emma's closer to, where you have a biopolymer and you need to add some functional groups or remove some functional groups. You can design an enzyme to do that. So maybe that's where I should pass to Emma and let her.
Yeah, I think, I agree with you, Peter, that you know there's been a lot learned through the deconstruct, reconstruct paradigm, you know, and about how enzymes work on these renewable materials and how to make them and make them cheaper. But you're right, you know, I think about it as sort of domesticating the biomass. You know, so you've got one of the challenges to using renewable biomass and materials is the complexity. That's something that we know we need to handle. And so the sorts of enzymes, the sorts of biological modifications we do is really to take this complex, heterogeneous material and domesticate it, but domesticate it post-harvest, because we realize, you know, some of the concerns, depending on where you are with regulatory considerations around the world, that some of the GMO plants might be questionable. But anyhow, there's also a lot we can do post-harvest using biocatalysts to add and, as you say, remove, selectively remove functional groups to achieve the performance properties that we're looking for from these intact polymers that nature is making. And some of the advantages that we see with that approach in parallel with the deconstruction and fermentation and, you know, rebuilding the polymer with that paradigm is the enzyme, the loading of the catalyst we need to use. So the biological catalyst, of course, is the enzyme. Just want to make sure that that's clear for the audience. The loading of that enzyme is typically much less than what would be required to fully deconstruct that biomass into fermentable sugars. And so there's a cost benefit to that, too. So we think about, you know, lowering or you know, think about the economic feasibility through lowering the enzyme loading, keeping it simple, and focusing on tailoring, on domesticating these complex starting materials into ones that then have reproducible performance. And you know, we can show it. We can demonstrate this approach can work nicely, and I'll go on too long with too many examples. So, but we can get the back there later, well, later in the conversation.
I'm going to circle back with a question on enzymatic modification, but and Jake, I think you bring a great side of this from the thermochemical side of manipulation of these biomasses to valorize them into new places, and I think some of the things. I'm curious if you agree or disagree, but it seems like a lot of what we're seeing today, the technology pathway, we knew 40 years ago or longer, like the old is the new, right? So some of these things, we knew how to do it before. It wasn't an incentive to do it, like turning off pathways to maximize the efficiency of a certain yield that you're looking for. So I'm curious your thoughts on that side.
Oh yeah, I couldn't agree more. I will give a little plug for a funding application that actually myself, Peter, and Kelly were on. Unfortunately, we didn't get the funding. You know, funding doesn't always go through, and that's okay. But the concept is kind of what you're saying, Kelly, is where you can take sugars. So, of course, when we're talking about sugars, that's, you know, a single monomer unit of cellulose, which is what we were talking about before. And we can process them microbially. To make a molecule called lactic acid. And lactic acid is kind of seen everywhere. You know, it's in a lot of food products. When our muscles and when our bodies get very tired, specifically when we're doing cardiovascular activity, we start to generate a lot of lactic acid. And in that case, it's actually a bad, painful thing. But it's very well established how to take microbes and have them eat sugar and poop out lactic acid. And they can do this in a very efficient way. They can turn 100% of the carbon in the sugar into lactic acid. And it just so turns out that lactic acid is three atoms away from acrylic acid, which is, of course, the base material, the base monomer for any acrylate polymer that you could make. And, of course, this is extremely relevant for packaging. So what we were trying to do is partner with a company that already has an established process to take sugars and turn them into lactic acid, and then engineer thermochemical. So what I mean by that is non-biological pathway to take your lactic acid and transform it into acrylic acid. And once again, Kelly, as you were saying, this has been around, this idea has been around for 40 years because it's very easy to look at this molecule and go, oh, well, if we take out this molecule of water, it's acrylic acid. And there are plenty of other folks in industry working on this. And I'm very confident that this type of a route will become commercially relevant sooner rather than later.
I'm glad you mentioned lactic acid because, you know, lactic acid is a combination of all of these things, right? It is a fermented molecule. It is a nature-derived fermentation product that we can use to make polylactic acid. We can use it to make acrylic acid. And from acrylic acid, a lot of your adhesives, a lot of your coatings are acrylic chemistry. So there's a lot in packaging that little really important circularity of lactic acid in nature and in our human body. Lactic acid has a lot of really cool little loops in it. And we just tap into that loop and we keep turning it back in the loop. Lactic acid becomes more sustainable because you can of its multiple ways in which you can use it. Now I'm coming to you, Emma, and I say, okay, I get it. Now I want to take a cellulosic chain and put a specific type of functionality on it. Can you design that enzyme for me? How do you make that for me?
Mm-hmm. Pretty easily. And the reason now, anyhow, the reason being we've, as both Drake and Peter know well, we've learned a lot about which enzymes microorganisms have evolved to grow on and, you know, consume biomass through projects focused on, you know, biomass to energy or commodity chemicals. We've learned a lot about how microbes have evolved to do that. And so now we've got a library, an enormous genomic library, that we can tap into and produce the corresponding enzymes and apply them in ways they weren't necessarily evolved for, but that mm-hmm. we can imagine using them for. And so that's what we do. We are using the enzymes in a different way. We learn how microbes have leveraged their activity, and we think, oh, that's pretty cool. And, you know, I can take that enzyme out of the microbial system and just use it in isolation as any other catalyst, and have it introduce specific targeted new chemical functionalities into cellulose, hemicellulose structures. As you might know, that the chemist at the chemical level, cellulose is won't say simple, but there's a lot of repeated units, right? Very similar repeated units. And so the interest in using an enzyme to add new functionality is that it can, with all that apparently very similar chemistry, still target a specific position and introduce functional groups in a highly targeted way. And that's what's so important to achieving the performance, like reproducible performance attributes at the end with the materials. So mm-hmm. we've just to add on to that, why we can do this now, why the timing is good to think about enzymes not only for degrading biomass, but also upgrading biomass, is because we know much more about the toolkit, and because of real advances in material science and surface analysis methods that help us characterize the products we're making. Mm-hmm. That was really tough before. And so this has been enabling for us as well.
I kind of feel like that may be some of the scare from the larger mm-hmm. chemical companies mm-hmm. that now have to go into nature to find their new molecules, is that mm-hmm. if you gave them a jar of something, they don't know how to analyze it because it's not yeah. what they analyze today. So I think characterization is an important part. And yeah. I think I want Peter's thoughts on the same topic and Jake's, but then I want to go into how does AI now allow us to move even faster? I'm curious your thoughts on that.
That's a can of worms, Kelly, that we'll open up in a minute, but I just want to Emma, has kind of got me excited about, enzymes and cellulose and so forth. And you mentioned nanocellulose, so I want to circle back to that really quick. So nanocellulose, in my opinion, is kind of a happy medium between complete deconstruction, which is taken all the way down to monomeric sugars, which in my opinion is too far in many cases, and no deconstruction at all, right? So, and I'll take one step back. So if you look at the way you can make money from biomass now, the big money makers are like pulp and paper, cotton fibers, construction lumber. These are the big ones that I'm thinking of. If there's another one, please shout it out. But those are the lignocellulosic products that make money. And if you look at the ways that don't make money, they're basically biofuels. So they're like, it's a great way to lose money. And this has been proven time and time again. It's to take a bunch of biomass and depolymerize it all the way down to sugars and do fermentation to ethanol and try to sell that ethanol. That's a great way to lose a whole bunch of money and taxpayer money and everyone else's money. So there's a happy medium. I think nanocellulose might sit right there. I mean, it can do really cool things, and it preserves a lot of that. It's energy efficient in the sense that the polymeric bonds that were initially constructed via sunlight are still there. So it's, you still have the energy efficiency, and the properties are really cool. I mean, you can make really transparent, like nice transparent films from nanocellulose that look a lot like, a polypropylene film. Much better oxygen barrier, poor water barrier, but you could imagine, coupling them to something that's more hydrophobic, maybe a lignin coating or something could help. The surface area is fantastic. If you want to make foams and, people have made all sorts of, catalysts and things from nanocellulose supports, just taking advantage of the nanoscale properties. And you can make them with enzymes too, is the other thing I wanted to touch on. So the same enzymes that will take cellulose all the way down to glucose, if you just back up a little bit, don't hit it so hard as Emma was suggesting, you end up with, the crystalline regions being preserved. And then you have cellulose nanocrystals, and there's a bunch of cool stuff you can do with it. I think we're right on the cusp of seeing big time commercial products. I don't think there's really, it's a chicken and egg scenario. There's not a big market pull. There's not a nanocellulose product on the shelves at Walmart yet. When that happens, then, when someone's like, oh man, we really need nanocellulose to make this thing that everybody wants, then you're going to see, maybe the pulp and paper companies who are, the most change averse companies in the world will say, okay, they could start making nanocellulose in ton quantities today. If they wanted to.
I'm going to challenge you a little bit on that. I think we started this all of this started with nanocellulose, and it's called cellophane and cellulose acetate.
Yeah.
Because you're dissolving the cellulose such that each strand is individually solubilized, and then you're controlling its recombination. So you're controlling hornification and the bringing together of cellulose chains. So packaging started with nanocellulose. So why are we so afraid of it?
I'll push back a little bit. So you're 100% right about that, Kelly. But the definition of nano, at least my definition, implies some degree of aggregation. So you have, instead of individual chains, you actually have nanoparticles that are, maybe dozens of chains still stuck together. But you're right. I mean, and cellophane, for the viewers, listeners who don't know, cellophane is still awesome. It's still out there and it's still a great product. So let's not forget about that. Okay, I've said enough. Jake, do you want to respond to any of that stuff?
Yeah, this is a great discussion. I think I'll add one thing, and I think it kind of goes off of what you and Kelly were just talking about, Peter, where you're saying the distinction between different types of nanocellulose, breaking these things down, the difficulty of that, something you said earlier, Kelly, where you said the thing that a lot of companies are scared of right now is that they don't know how to deal with biomass. And they have a point. I mean, so Peter said earlier, the best thing, as a baseball fan, I very much agree with it, the best thing you can do with a piece of wood is make a baseball bat. And part of the reason why that's so efficient is because you don't have to break your wood into its constituent monomers and molecules. Because when that starts to happen, unlike with, say, crude oil, which is something that we have figured out how to engineer over the last 100 odd years, wood and other sources of biomass are extremely complex just because they have so many more types of molecules and atoms in them. So crude oil do a balance, you know, you've got a couple percentages of things that aren't that, it's mostly hydrogen and carbon. But when you start to throw in biomass, you've got oxygen. And not only is that just a third type of atom that we all have to keep track of, but also when you process it down and try to get it down to a molecular scale, you end up creating a lot of things that you didn't mean to create. There's a fellow at NREL who always refers to these things as tar balls that you essentially don't know what to do with, can't process further. And that really not only hampers your ability to build the process because you can't trace where all of your mass is flowing, but it also, much more pragmatically, starts to gum up your equipment in ways that more traditional hydrocarbon feedstocks, so hydrocarbons being sources of crude oil, natural gas, those types of things, they don't do that as much. So it's kind of a, requires a step change in how we deal with kind of unknown stuff.
Yeah, but I would say there has been real advances in selective extraction, right? So the fractionation of lignocellulosic biomass into simpler component parts. But you're right, that's all, you know, what you're saying is when we think about, I think, Kelly, you put it like, you know, what are people afraid of? Two things. One is new chemistry. I'm not sure it's particularly more complex, but it's new. And so there's a learning curve. But we've learned a lot. And we have tools that can help tailor the complexity, reduce the complexity. And that is an area of interest for us. And the other, I don't know if we want to go in this direction, but I have heard that concern is feedstock supply. And this is, if we start to then invest in biological feedstocks, and here again is another chicken and egg. I think the feedstock suppliers, like the forest sector, ag sector as well, are unsure, you know, who gets to benefit. And so there's still some questions around that. But I would say that at least thinking about the forest sector in Canada, and I'm sitting here in Nordic Europe, there's some commonality here too. There's an interest to diversify because the traditional products just aren't, the markets aren't there. So there is feedstock in waiting. And part of mindful land use is to use in a sustainable way, the forest resources, and again to say they're there waiting, but I think some decisions, some clarity around who gets the benefit, you know, from the collection and the initial processing and using all that, you know, also hundreds of years of knowledge around how to fractionate lignocellulosic material. That's what a pulp mill does. You know, they're experts at it. How to kind of reconfigure that understanding for new applications. This is an area of interest for them.
And you mentioned pulp mills. So I think it's worth, this is a great conversation for that. So 93% of the world's pulp comes from the Kraft process. The Kraft process uses trees when we know there's more cellulose in plants than in trees. Why do we use trees? Because the Kraft process has to amortize the sins of the process. And we know they've gotten cleaner. They burn stuff to create their own energy, but still the first step is don't screw up the lignin, don't cross-link the lignin. So black liquor is because you've thermally cross-linked the lignin. You have to separate the biomass in a cleaner, greener way into its bits and pieces so then you can valorize them. So I think part of it too is the fact that that's our experience. We're not used to saying, well, what do we do with the liquid extractions from the craft process? That's true. Mean the black liquor that we can't do anything with? No, you got to pull the plant apart.
For energy. Yeah,
exactly. And I feel like there's going to take time before these large global chemical companies start realizing to start recruiting, you know, biochemical engineers and biology majors out of school, not chemistry majors and chemical engineers. So that's going to take some time. So how do we help them? In the interim, I think a big part of that is realizing that you got to redefine scale first. Start small. I'm going to give you a quick little example. So recently I met with Montgomery County, Ohio, which is where Dayton, Ohio is. And I went there because there's a compost facility there that was part of a recent study. And it started with that county realizing that they have 180,000 family food shortage, and they want to protect those 180,000 families. So it started with a food bank, making sure that grocery store produce doesn't get wasted. Then they started growing food. Then they started composting, and consumers participate in the program. They drop off their buckets of compost, $5 a month, get a new bucket, and every year they get that much compost back for their own home gardening. All beautiful, cool little story, right? But it's a county that's representing itself like it's its own country, and it needs to protect its own people. I think that's a big step. But they also are public sector. They don't have the funding. They don't have the resources they did pre-pandemic. So they're not going to take on anything that's going to cause them pain or conflict, because that's what where they're at. But this one county has the second, maybe the largest transfer station in the country. 600,000 tons of waste goes into this one transfer facility. That's 1.2 billion pounds, of which 12 to 18% is food waste. Using 30 to 60% carbohydrate content, if we say 50%, that's 90 million pounds of lactic acid, carbon negative lactic acid that I can make polymer with. I can make lactic acid derivatives with. So I think it's all there, but somebody has to be willing to do it. And I think we're underestimating that governments around the world want to do a few things. Decarbonize industry. They want to get food waste out of landfills. And we know that composters want food waste. I believe compost demand is inevitable because it's our fastest way to turn dirt back into soil. We are officially in the eighth era in human history called the New Materials Age. The plastics era was the last one. We realized that we can't continue to operate that way. Then that lactic acid circularity starts to run, and you can start to build off of that.
You know, in terms of scalability and, you know, circularity, plants got it figured out, man. And there's so much we can learn from them, you know, and scalability shouldn't even come into question. I mean, cellulose synthesis is by far the most abundant polymeric process. You can't turn it off. it's happening. No,
I could take you into my backyard and show you that you can't turn
it off. Yeah, no kidding, man. It's crazy efficient. And in terms of, you know, we're talking about localized production, right? Plants are so good. So energy efficient, so material efficient, they don't move. Trees just sit there. They're good. They don't need to move things around. I mean, maybe they need to get water from their roots to their leaves and so on, but that's it. They don't have to ship things around the country. There's so much we can learn about, you know, circular production of the materials that we need, you know, from plants. And they make fantastic materials. I mean, they're robust. We've been using them since humans have been around. We're still using them, you know, they still outperform a lot of the polymers and stuff that we can make. So I really like the metaphor, I guess, or maybe it's just a fact that we are moving into a new materials age, and hopefully it's bio-based materials.
If it's not sustainable, it's not sustainable.
That's right, man.
Use those intact polymers. Well, look, this was a lot of fun, guys. For my first podcast of this new series, I couldn't be happier to share that with you. So thank you so much for joining me. It was a pleasure. Hopefully we'll do another one real soon. Appreciate
it. Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you, Kelly. Thanks. Good to see you, Jake and Peter.
All right. Thanks, everybody.